climbed slowly to his feet inside the cumbersome suit.
"Okay, boss,"
he replied with exaggerated deference.
"To hear is to obey."
Joanna did not notice any humor in his crack. She detailed Monique to stand guard over the rock and ordered the other four to scour the area for other green spots. Connors, in his white hard-shell suit, stood to one side like a policeman, observing without participating. Joanna headed back toward the spot where she had left her sample cases, almost skipping across the rocky desert sands.
"Only dub,"
Monique's voice sounded amused. Jamie asked,
"Say, were any of us smart enough to bring a camera with him?"
"I have a camera,"
said Toshima. Jamie said,
"Could you take a series of snaps of the rock and the region around it from every angle, complete 360 degrees?
"Most certainly."
Jamie thought back to hunting trips he had taken with his grandfather Al. They would always snap photos of each other with their catch. Deer, rabbit, even the Gila monster that Jamie had shot with his .22 when he had been no more than 10 years old. His mother hated to allow Jamie to go hunting, but his father could not stand up to Grandfather Al's determination. "You can't keep the boy cooped up in our library all the time," Al would argue. "He ought to be out in the open." Then, when they were alone together up in the wooded hills, his grandfather would tell him, "They're trying to make you 100% white, Jamie. I just want you to keep a little bit of yourself red, like you ought to be." Jamie looked back at the rock, small enough to pick up and carry, especially in this light gravity. "It'd make a great photo to send back to my grandfather," he thought. "Me inside this damned suit with the rock for my trophy." But he did not pose for Toshima's camera. Joanna returned after nearly half an hour with Voznesensky at her side, toting the two hefty silver-coated specimen boxes plus a pair of long, slim poles that looked to Jamie like fishing rods. He knew that they were marker poles with tiny radio beacons at their tips. He grinned to himself. Joanna's even got the Russian working for her now.
"I wondered if I would ever have to use these,"
she was chattering.
"I never thought I would need them on the first day of field work."
The others had found no other spots of green in the 100 meters or so they had examined in all directions around the rock. The soil was crisscrossed now with the prints of their cleated boots, except for a sacrosanct half-meter surrounding the rock. No one had dared to come any closer for fear of damaging or destroying some vital evidence. Voznesensky stopped and bent slightly forward, hands on hips, as if doing obeisance to the rock. In his bright red suit, he looked to Jamie like a fat bell pepper with a hump on its back. Joanna took charge.
"Do not touch the rock. Before we do anything, I will need soil samples for the ground immediately around the rock and then underneath it." "I can use the corer,"
Jamie said, reaching for the tool at his belt.
"It attaches to the pole, so we can get samples from as deep as 5 meters.
"Good,"
said Joanna.
"That can also tell us if there is permafrost beneath the surface, no?"
asked Ilona, sounding excited for the first time since they had landed. He nodded. Then, realizing no one could see the gesture through his tinted visor, he added,
"Yes, that's right."
Voznesensky commanded,
"Pete, bring the video camera here. We must have a record of this."
The astronaut said,
"Right,"
and headed back toward the camera he had left on its tripod.
"My still camera is almost out of film,"
Toshima said.
"I will take the last few frames now and change roles." "No,"
snapped Nagib.
"Don't take the chance of high energy radiation spoiling the film. Here, take my camera. It has a full roll in it." "Thank you,"
said Toshima. Connors lumbered into sight again, dangling the vidcam in one gloved hand. When he was satisfied that both still and video photographers were ready, Voznesensky ordered,
"Proceed."
But no one moved until Joanna said,
"I want 4 samples, one from each side of the rock, as far down as you can go."
Then she added,
"Please."
Jamie leaned on the pole, and the corer bit into the ground. It buzzed through the first few centimeters easily enough, but then the going got tough. Jamie pushed hard, breaking into a sweat.
"It's gotten like hard pan,"
he grunted.
"Or permafrost?"
Ilona suggested hopefully. Jamie pulled up the pole and let Patel, his fellow geologist, work the mechanism that neatly dropped the slim column of red dirt from the corer's sharp teeth into one of Joanna's sample boxes. Patel worked slowly, carefully, to make certain that the crumbly cylinder did not break apart. Jamie noted that the column was striated, different shades of red. Fluvial deposits, he guessed. There must have been an ocean here at one time, or at least a big lake. 4 samples from the sides of the rock. Jamie had to stop his digging several times to let the fans of his suit clear away the mist that built up inside his visor. Despite his exertions, neither Patel nor any of the others made the slightest move to help him. Instead, they peered at the samples and invented instant theories to explain their appearance. They're all too entranced with what's going on to even think of helping, he told himself. Besides, they got an engine to do the heavy work. Why should they bother with it?
All right now,
said Joanna, after 4 samples were resting in the first case. She sank slowly to her knees and bent over the rock. Jamie got down beside her.
You'll need help lifting.
No!
She snapped.
I can do it myself. This is Mars, after all.
Jamie flushed with sudden anger and then felt sheepish. She's right. The damned rock only weighs a few pounds here, and she's not going to let anybody touch it but herself. Hoshima clicked away, and Connors focused the vidcam tightly on the rock as Joanna reached out and grasped it at both ends, keeping clear of the green patch on its side. She tugged the rock up off the ground and placed it inside the other silver sample case as tenderly as a mother laying her newborn infant in its crib. Jamie stared hard at the ground beneath the rock. Flattened and smoothed by the rock's weight, but otherwise no different from the rest of the soil. What did you expect, he asked himself. A Martian rattlesnake coiled up under it?
Now, if you will please take a core sample from the ground that was beneath the rock,
Joanna said as she sealed the lid of her sample case.
How deep? As deep as you can go,
she said.
If you please.
Jamie did it. While they all watched in silence, he dug the pole in as far as it could go. Gently, delicately, he pulled the core sample up.
Look!
Shouted Monique Bonnet.
What? What is it? I thought...
She was almost breathless.
When you pulled out this stick, I thought I saw sunlight glinting off something. Something? What? Was it water droplets?
Ilona asked.
Perhaps,
said Monique.
I don't know. It was gone in the blink of an eye.
Ilona dropped to her knees so hard that Jamie was afraid she would hurt herself or bang up her suit. She wormed her gloved hand down into the hole that he had dug and pulled it out swiftly. The sleeve of the suit was smeared with reddish dust and crumbling bits of rust-colored dirt.
Look! Look!
A half dozen tiny, glinting drops of moisture were on her gloved fingers, like dew on the petals of a flower. Before any of them could say a word, the droplets disappeared, evaporating into the thin, cold Martian air.
It's water. It must be water,
Monique said, her voice vibrating with excitement.
Below the ground! Water!
Nagui was laughing like a schoolboy.
We've discovered water. The first water found on an extraterrestrial body. It's only a few drops, but it's water. And liquid water at that.
Jamie stood there, leaning on the pole. All his physical tiredness from the digging evaporated just like the droplets from Ilona's glove. The others were practically capering, waving their arms and almost dancing in their hard suits. They were so thrilled. All except Joanna, who remained kneeling before the hole that Jamie had dug for her like a worshiper at a strange altar, flanked on either side by her filled and carefully sealed sample cases. And Jamie, who stood behind her with the pole gripped in both hands, standing like a Navajo warrior with his lance butted on the dusty ground, wondering what his colleagues would do if that green patch actually turned out to be real, living Martian organisms. Dossier, Joanna Maria Drumado. At the age of 16, Joanna took her first lover and learned that her mother was dying. An only child, she had spent all her life at home under the gentle, loving hand of a mother who never raised her voice, yet ruled her household absolutely. When she was younger, Joanna had adored her father, who traveled the world over and was enormously respected and admired. As she began to understand the urges flowing within her own body, though, she started to see her father with new eyes. She realized that women, even her mother's friends and students her own age, looked at Alberto Brumado with more than respect and admiration in their glances. Your father is handsome and very romantic, Joanna's mother told her. Why shouldn't other women yearn for him? And she smiled to show that she was not concerned about her husband's faithfulness. He loves us too much.